This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. This is the week of my 80th birthday. And I've been wondering what to do. I could bring on guests who would tell me what a great birthday milestone it is. I could ignore it and just do another interview. I love doing interviews. I do an interview every week, and I have been doing an interview every week for many, many years. Or I could do something else, and that's what the show seems to always kind of be about, is the something else. Everybody's talking about disclosure and having various people on. We've had Jonathan Blitch on, and that was really our only foray into that area for the simple reason that, A, I don't think it's going to unfold unless the visitors want it to. And I don't have any information about how ready they are. I do know this, that they watch very carefully. They are well aware of our media, and they watch every single thing about them. And they have the facilities to do that for sure. Around the world, not just in the United States or the Western Europe. And they are constantly measuring whether or not we are going to be excessively shocked by their appearance. And when they decide we aren't, that is when this is going to change. My whole life is about reducing that level of shock by going out there and telling the wildest possible stories, and I have a feeling they might actually concoct experiences for me that are super wild in order that I will tell those stories and people can get used to the strangest part of this. Because, gosh, I certainly had a lot of strange things happen to me. And that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today, but not in the usual way. I'm going to go back to the beginning and talk about my childhood. I talk very little about what it was like to be me, a little boy in San Antonio, Texas, in the 1950s. I've talked in the secret school. I tried in the secret school to write about experiences I had then. But then reading back, I'm not sure how much is imagination and how much isn't. So I'm going to basically weave a picture of my life as it was then, including all of crazy stories. I was a wild child. I had a lot of fun, and I was a trickster and a prankster from the age of 3, if not before, practically from the time I could walk. I'm going to tell a lot of those stories, and I'm going to weave in stories of the weird things that happened, some of which I have reconstructed, and I'll tell you exactly what I remember directly and what I don't. And I'm not going to talk about any of the things that are either must be imaginary or seem to me to be impossible. Okay. I'm going to start, I think, with, I'm not going to do this in sequence exactly. I'm going to start with one that, of course, forms the core of the secret school and has got to be one of the weirdest of all. I don't have the same kind of direct memories of this that I do of some of the other stories I'm going to tell you. In fact, I would never even have brought this story up because I can't figure out how I could have done it. I lived on Elizabeth Road in Terrell Hills, Texas. I remember going at night into the Almas Basin, which is a swampy, kind of creepy area. It's a floodplain, basically. And up the far end of it, and sitting on some benches that were just behind a very unusual tree, which I describe in The Secret School. It was all impossible. I could not possibly, at the ages of 9 and 10, have gone out in the dark and ridden my bicycle all the way across to the Almas Basin and gone down into the basin and crossed it? No. So why in the world do I remember it? And then I found the tree. I actually found the tree in the basin, just as I remembered it. So I'm complete. And then, behind the tree, there were the ruined benches that we used to sit on. All I can think of, and there was a teacher in a black robe, and I wish my parents were still alive, because I think what really happened was that there was a teacher. There were nuns in an old sister's home behind the, just beyond that, those benches. And I think that I did sit on those benches with other children and was taught by a nun. And I do not think that she was an alien. The tree was there, and I would have known that as a little boy. And somehow or another, the memory got mixed up into something that happened at night and the teacher being very mysterious. But if you read The Secret School, she doesn't really tell us anything that a well-versed teacher of science couldn't have known at that time. So I'm thinking that that's a distorted memory of a real event. I want to put that out on the table because I'm no liar, and I don't want to misinform people about anything. Of course, there is another factor, and that is that there could have been an anomalous level to this. I just don't know. Okay, now that's one thing. Well, let's go back a little farther. I want to go back and tell you about what I really was like and what my life was like as a boy and why I remember my childhood with such a complex mix of emotions, fondness, pleasure, happiness, laughter, fear, sadness, all of it mixed up together in quite a childhood. We lived in what was then considered quite a big house on Elizabeth Road. There's another house there now, even bigger in the property. One of my earliest memories is of the age of 3, when I got found an acorn somewhere. There weren't any oak trees in our area, so I planted the acorn. And the acorn is now a huge red oak in the front yard of that same house. Oddly enough, the motto of the school I went to, Mount Sacred Heart, out on Bassey Road in San Antonio, still there and a lovely school by all accounts, was "Great oaks from little acorns grow." And I guess I planted my little acorn a little bit before I found this. I was sent to the school at the age of 6. Oh my. As some of these are going to be very funny stories. Here's maybe the first of those. I was very obsessive and concentrated. I have a tremendous sense of, I can really concentrate on things. This is why in the book The Grays, the little boy in it has a single hair paintbrush and he paints little toy men that fit into miniature figures that fit into railroad, HO size railroad sets with a single hair brush so that he can paint the eyes and the neckties, decorate the neckties and everything. You're looking at him. I didn't have the money. My daddy wouldn't give me the money for a big HO set. I wish he had. So I painted the figures very carefully. And for some unknown reason, I would hide them in the school in the afternoons as I was leaving. And then imagine them coming to life at night and walking through the school and climbing up the steps and everything. And in the morning, they'd usually be gone. And I guess the janitor would find them and think, what in the world? Who painted this thing like this? And put them in his pocket. Just throw them out. I don't know. Anyway, the first thing I did using that extremely intense concentration, obsessive concentration, was this. I got a hold of a saw. You remember? No, I'm just a little tiny thing. And our maid had a room. Her maid's room was off the side of the house, and it had a little porch on it. And I worked all day, apparently. I have no memory of this. My mother and father used to tell this story. And, of course, the maid herself told it too. A good sawing the porch off of the maid's room for some unknown reason. I have no idea why I would do that. Anyway, I sawed her porch off. And she came back after supper to go home, tired, I guess, and listen to the radio. We didn't have any TV in those days, and there wasn't any. And as she stepped onto the porch, it fell off the side of the maid's room. She was furious, of course. I suppose I was punished. And in those days, you get spankings. I don't approve of that, and I never did that in my own life to my own children. But in those days, it was a different world, and it was considered the normal thing. So I'm not going to second-guess the past and say, oh, how awful they were, et cetera, and so forth. They were just trying to be themselves and do their best. I think people who go back to the past and condemn people for doing things that they thought were right at the time because they had no other standards to judge by are wrong. We need to accept the past as it is and move on and try to do better in the future. Not hide the past from ourselves in order to pretend to ourselves that it wasn't really there. I don't think so. Anyway, back in those days, I became obsessed with making traps for some reason. Still three or so. Yeah, I still was three. And we had a back garden, a backyard, big backyard with my sister had chickens in it and a chicken coop, little banty chickens, bantam chickens they were called. And she was very obsessed with her chickens. She was 18 months older than me. So she was 4 and a half at the time. And I loved the chickens too. And the chickens were protected by a cat, oddly enough, called Chicken Cat. We had a donkey, and we had Chicken Cat, and we had a dog called Prissy, my mama's dog. And a big yard, and it was mostly just open fields around us. My grandfather used to go fox hunting in the area in those days with his horses and his dogs, to give you an idea of how rural it was. So I'm thinking back now. I don't remember where I got all this stuff, probably in storage somewhere in the house, but I got all kinds of things. Now, again, I remember vaguely building the trap. There was a rock wall and a gate in the rock wall, an open gate. It didn't have a closed gate in it. But there were two gate posts there. You could have put a gate on it if you'd wanted to. I wrapped clothesline around the gate posts and somehow or another ended up with a floor lamp, which became part of the whole thing. And so I built all of this. A few days before, actually the previous weekend, my father, who did not like cats, had given Chicken Cat away to a rancher we knew. A lovely guy, his house was on a way up on top of a hill north of San Antonio. And I loved going up there and playing on the porch with the beautiful view and the breeze and the smell of mom and dad's and his wife's highballs. I used to love the smell of highballs. One time at our country house, the family, the parents were all inside, and I was still, I guess I was about four. I drank my mother's highball down to the dregs. I drank it dry. They came out and found the highball gone and me pretty much gone too, sitting there saying, "Look at the moon coming up over the valley." Only there was no moon. Of course, maybe I was seeing something else. Who knows? Something they couldn't see. In any case, I built my trap. And I went to bed. Little boy, 7 o'clock, go to bed. No Chicken Cat. 2 o'clock in the morning, the baddies begin to cluck and scream. Obviously, Daddy has left them open to possums, which abounded in the area, and foxes. So something's gotten into the chicken coop, and it's getting the chickens. Daddy goes rushing out, rushes through the gate, and instead of getting to the chicken coop, ends up lurching around in the backyard, attached to a floor lamp, which he certainly did not expect to have happen. He eventually extracted himself from the floor lamp and saved a few of the chickens, but not many. Then the question became, we have to get more chickens for my sister. But how to protect them? We have to get a better chick, build a better chicken coop. Then, a few days after that, Chicken Cat returned, came up the driveway, and returned to the house. And so my mother called the rancher and said, "Chicken Cat's back." And he said, "Yeah, I know. He didn't like, we thought he'd love our barn because it's full of all kinds of varmints, but he didn't. He just left." Chicken Cat had walked about 15, 20 miles all the way back to the house on his own, unless the rancher or Daddy quietly brought Chicken Cat back and left him at the foot of the hill where our house was. I don't know the truth, but we've always thought Chicken Cat came back. And from then on, Chicken Cat lived with the bandies and protected them from varmints. And Daddy never figured out, I don't think, exactly why he ended up attached to a floor lamp in his underpants in the middle of the night in the backyard. Goodness, 80 years. You know, I remember things that you wouldn't believe. I remember Harry Truman. I remember Lord's LSMFT, Lucky Strike Means Fine Tobacco, and all of the people against Democrats would say, it means Lord save me from Truman. Truman won, though, and he was a good president in some ways. I've often wondered, should he have dropped the bomb? Or should he have demonstrated the bomb out in the Pacific to the Japanese, had them come out there and showed them the bomb? I don't know. I do know that one of my uncles, probably wouldn't have lived through World War II if we had invaded Japan. And I have a feeling a lot of people the world would not be the same, because an awful lot more Japanese and an awful lot of Americans would have died in that struggle for those islands. Those decisions are the kinds of decisions that we're going to have to make more of soon, when the visitors start to emerge, if they do in my lifetime, and they may. I don't care much about disclosure. I don't think it's very a real thing. I mean, maybe someday that's how it will happen, that there will be an official level of admission about this. But I just don't know. I just don't know. They seem so elusive and so unwilling. You know, I have had in my life many instances in which I probably, if I had worked at it, could have gotten pictures, but they will not allow that. Their attitude is that a single picture that is undeniable with witnesses, etc., which one of my cameras probably would change everything and would immediately redirect us toward them before we're ready. And by ready, I mean especially the intellectuals, the religious people, the scientists, and the academics have gotten used to the idea that this could be real. The ordinary people, the yous and the me's of the world, we're already ready. We've been ready for a long time. We're used to it. Not them. Not them. And you look at what's going on Wikipedia right now. They're running around boulderizing the Wikipedia entries of all kinds of people, even Gary Nolan and the Soul Foundation, because they're realizing that this is real, and that is causing them to go into a state of shock, ontological shock, shock of the new, because they're facing the fact that the world as they understood it is not real. And that's hard, because they have built that understanding bit by bit since the beginning of history, and especially since the Enlightenment in the late 18th century and the Renaissance before that. This is precious. This is precious. This is the core of our world, our worldview. And they are about to lose it. We've lost it many times. It's nothing new. I'll tell you, the greatest single revolution in the history of mankind is never, not even called a revolution. It is the collapse of the Roman Empire, where a whole world established for thousands of years around fundamental core beliefs in gods, self-destructed primarily because those gods did not help the people survive plague after plague after plague that started in 100 AD. And they would sacrifice, and it was a serious business to sacrifice in those days. If you're interested in this, get Jesus a New Vision. All of this is in it. And it's the only place this is put together. There's no one ever else has put this together like this. Anyway, in 100 AD, something changed that we don't ever think about. But the science is quite clear, because we've examined stalagmites, in a cave in Scotland. And from that, we have been able to determine the different changes in solar output. And I'm not going to go into how that all works, but it's very good science. It's solid science. And in about 100 AD, the solar output slightly increased. And what is known as the Roman climate optimum, which started in about 500 BC, ended. For 600 years, the Mediterranean basin had been a verdant, well-watered, temperate area. Not like it is now, which is still very dry. But in 100 AD, suddenly that changed, and they began to have drought after drought after drought. They prayed to their gods. They began to get ill because they were They were hungry. They didn't get enough food. And they were traveling on roads that they had built all around the Mediterranean basin. The Roman Empire had built them, and moving over over the water constantly. The Romans called the Mediterranean Mare Nostrum, our sea. And they used sea travel was a huge industry in ancient Rome, meaning that people who had always been completely isolated from one another were suddenly mingling all together all over the empire and bringing their diseases from home with them. So local disease outbreaks became epidemics, then pandemics, then vast plagues. And they prayed, and they gave sacrifice. They gave the best they had, their best bulls, their best cows, their best produce to the temples, their money. They gave everything they could to those gods in those temples, those beautiful painted statues. And you know what? Nothing happened. Not a damn thing. Because those gods weren't real. They're in here. In the fourth mind, I talk a little bit about where the gods are and what they are. The gods represent psychological states of great power within us. If you want a deep dive into human psychology, go to the Hindu gods and the stories of the Hindu gods, which are still very alive in our world today, and you will take a journey into yourself unlike any journey you could ever possibly imagine. It's there. The lives of those deities reflect the journey of the soul in its travails and its wandering across the fields of life. And the Roman gods did too, although not as richly, nearly, as the much more evolved Hindu deities do. But they were still basically in here. But we're a strange breed, and we can kind of bring them out here too, to an extent. And they can become part of us and part of the world around us at the same time, but not so much that they could change what was happening in the Roman Empire. And that's why you see the statues of the ancient Roman gods with their noses knocked off and their arms knocked off and so forth. People were taking clubs and beating them and hammerings, trying to kill the statues because they're trying to kill the gods because they thought the gods had turned against them. Out of all of this arose Christianity. Now, I'm going to get back to my childhood soon, so don't worry about that. Out of all this arose Christianity, a whole different way of looking at it. And a better way, closer to the truth, perhaps. In some ways, closer to the truth. In some ways, farther away from it, because it looks up to heaven instead of around to the world. You know, there's a beautiful piece of, there was an essayist, a Roman essayist called Apuleius, who wrote many essays, one of which is called The Florida, The Flowers. And it has a brief period of describing him walking through the woods on the way to a friend's house, I believe, as I recall, or maybe it was just a journey along the road. And he describes the way offerings and anointment was placed on this tree and that stone, etc., all around him as he walked along. This was reverence for the earth as gods, the things of the earth as gods. The indigenous peoples around the world still have that reverence. And it's unfortunate that we've lost it because we're in terrible trouble because we did. In any case, I'm not rambling. I only seem like I'm rambling. There's a difference, and it's an important difference. Now, going back to those days of my childhood, something was there, something very different from the old gods. something very different from our concept of deity now, too. But nevertheless, there. Was the hooded figure at the benches behind the nuns, old nun's place? Just an elderly nun who liked to teach, still liked to teach science to young children? Or was there more? Or was she herself more? Who was under that habit, that dark habit? Why did she teach us those things? Why were we brought there? Because that part of it happened. That the teaching part happened. I don't think I went there. I can't believe I went there on my own in the middle of the night at the ages of 9 and 10. But what happened there happened somehow or another. Let me tell you another funny story. I was not a bad boy. I was a very good little boy. I got only all straight A's in deportment in school. That was because I was clever. I was a devil, actually, but I was very clever. And somehow or another, our maid Annie got me mad at her. I was probably about 10. I have no idea. She probably punished me for something, and that I probably deserved punishment for. I don't remember. Anyway, I decided to get back at her. And what I decided to do was to put firecrackers in the toaster, because she came in every morning at 7 and started breakfast, and the first thing she did was put down toast. So there were these firecrackers. They're still around. You can buy them at a fireworks stand, called black cats, which are woven together. The fuses are woven together, and you can light one fuse at one end and throw it, and they'll all go off one after another. I put a line of black cats in the toaster between the elements and the little guard that guarded the toast from touching the elements. And I did that at night, about 9 o'clock at night, when everybody else was in the den watching, at this point, watching TV. By that time, we did have a TV. And I expected Annie to come in the next morning and put down the toast, and the toaster would start to blow up. I didn't think ahead very clearly, because if that had happened to Annie, she would have known immediately what it was and would have lost no time in coming after me. She would have known exactly who was responsible. So anyway, I went to bed, and suddenly in what seemed to be the dead of the night, was actually 5 o'clock in the morning, just before dawn. Blam, 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 blam. My bedroom was immediately above the kitchen, so I could see blue flashes flashing out across the front yard. And of course, I knew what was going on. I heard my mother downstairs running through the house from their bedroom, which was downstairs, running through the house yelling, "Carl, Carl," to my dad. His name was Carl. So I went down behind her, and I walked into the kitchen behind her, and he was sitting on the kitchen, little stool they had in the kitchen, his hand on his heart and this expression on his face. And he said, "The toaster exploded." And I could see it out in the kitchen garden, lying on its side, smoking, sort of faintly smoking. And I turned around. I went upstairs. I buried my face in my pillow, and I almost laughed myself unconscious. I could not believe how funny it was. Of course, I wasn't scared of him. I mean, I should have been, probably. Being a little boy, it didn't occur to me at any time that anyone would figure this out. Annie would have figured it out for sure. Mother certainly figured it out, because the next thing I hear, leaning over me, real close to my ear, her voice going, "How did you do that?" God. And I, in a moment of absolute internal self-discipline, beyond anything at that time I would have ever dreamed I could achieve, I sucked in the laughter. I closed my face up into a sleepy look, turned over and said, "Do what?" And she says, "Well, if your father ever figures it out, Whitty, you're going to be in a lot of trouble." He never did. And this gets me to Daddy and practical jokes. And my brother has had the same experience with him. You don't have to play, or didn't have to play. Daddy has gone to his reward, God help him. You didn't, and such a good man in many ways. I think he's gone to a good reward. I hope so. Anyway, you didn't have to play a prank on Daddy. That wasn't necessary. You just had to set up a prank somewhere in his general vicinity, and he would stumble into it every time. Mother would enjoy them. She would never tell him, and she would never rat on you. But if you played even the slightest prank on her, she'd say, "So, you're trying to kill your mother." As far as Annie was concerned, the maid, you did not play pranks on her. Not if you valued your life. She was not foolable. Anything unusual had happened, she blamed on me. "Whitty, come in here. How did you do that?" "I didn't do anything." "Well, yes, you did. Look at that chair. It's collapsed." "Well, I didn't do it." "Certainly you did." Speaking of chairs, I once decided to make an electric chair. What the heck I was thinking, I don't know. I was still little, probably even younger than the toaster. I was probably about 9. So I got an armchair, God help me, and I did get a significant amount of trouble over this one. And I got a couple of daddy's belts, and I nailed the belts to the arms of the chair so you could have things that would get you, force you to stay in the chair, and nailed another belt to the back of the chair so that the person could be strapped in. And then I connected an electrical cord with tape to the chair legs. And the plan was that to get Annie to sit in the chair and see if I could electrocute her. And so I offered her a quarter. And all she said was, "Your daddy sure is going to be mad about those belts, boy." And that was quite correct. He was very mad about the belts. Not as mad, though, as the time I put an egg in his hat. In those days, men always wore hats. And Dad was a lawyer, and he certainly wore a hat, a suit, and a hat when he went down to the office. And he left that morning and put on his hat and left, and nothing happened, and I was kind of disappointed. I looked for the egg in his closet, but it wasn't there. And the phone rang about an hour or so later. It was the summer, so I was at home. And Mother hung up and said, "Whitty, your father's coming home from the courthouse. You go hide in the back lot." There was a vacant lot behind our house. And I thought to myself, what's going on? He came home, and I could see him moving past the windows with his belt, a good belt, not the old belt, in his hand, looking for me. Finally, he went back to work. It developed that he never told me this story. Mother did. He never mentioned it at all, in fact. He played a lot of pranks when he was a boy, so he was fairly forgiving. This is what had happened. He had gone into the courtroom, one of the judges, to give present a motion or something. It wasn't a trial. And taken off his hat, whereupon the judge said, "Carl, are you trying a new baldness cure? And Dad said, well, no, Judge, I'm not. And he said, well, then why have you got an egg cracked over your head? Dad put on his hat, delivered the pleading, and left, getting home to beat me up, to get me with that belt, of course. And that was why Mother told me to go hide in the back lot so that he would cool down before he saw me. And he did cool down. He came home. When he came home, he didn't say a thing, and it was never mentioned again. But that must have been quite a moment in those very formal days in the courtroom when he took off his hat and had an egg cracked over his head. You know, there are a couple of things I remember, have remembered always from my childhood involving the visitors. One of them has to do with Daddy. And there are others in the secret school, but these are the ones that came to me from kind of base memory and that in some way probably are true. One of them is this. We had this country house. The family, my mother's side of the family, still owns it. It's absolutely beautiful, north of San Antonio. We used to go up there a lot, and we had our allotted times in the summer, our 2 weeks or our week and whatever. And my grandparents owned it at the time. And one night, Daddy came into my bedroom and picked me up and took me to the country house in the dead of the night. I sat in the car and we went up there and turned on any lights. Went out on the front porch. And I remember this squared off UFO kind of tumbling through the sky, glowing white and landing in the back pasture behind the house. And I don't recall being scared. I do recall Daddy becoming very still. And then I remember walking back into the pasture. And I don't remember what I did there. Except actually, as I'm talking now, I do remember sitting in a circle. And I remember having the impression that I was with children that I knew, other children. Now, this squared-off UFO plays an interesting role in my life because there were a number of people who would see a UFO on a deck at the old cabin in upstate New York, and it was big and sort of squared off. And when I was another one of the memories I have, and this came as a dream, but I'm pretty sure it's a memory, was I would make these, we had a hedge called a ligustrum hedge that had long saplings in it, and you could cut them off and whittle them down and make a little spear out of one that'd be about this long. And I would make spears in the afternoons sometimes because they were coming and I knew it. And they would land our next door neighbors. We had an acre of property and then there was an acre behind us. He had the both acres, so his backyard was very big. And this squared off UFO would land on in that backyard. And I would stand in our yard and throw my spears at it and tell him to go away. So I'm not sure why I wanted to do that, but I would know they were coming. I would know they were coming. And at the cabin, the old cabin, the UFO that would show up on the deck was squared off like that. And once people, we used to do Dreamland from KTSA Radio in San Antonio. They would do it as a courtesy to let us go in there and do the radio when we were still on Clear Channel. And the most remarkable thing happened. One night, people started coming up to the station saying that there was a very strange-looking square UFO over the station. And we were in the middle of a live show. We couldn't go out, and Ann and I didn't get to see it. But one of the engineers, as I recall, went out and saw it and said that it was squared off and glowing. I suppose there are probably communion letters with other people who have seen squared off UFOs, square-shaped UFOs. And I wonder if I met those people that there would be some kind of connection between us. Because you know what I think? I think that's a family affair. You know, I think this has to do with family somehow. I'm a very family conscious man. I have very much love for my whole big family. My Strieber family is pretty small compared to my mother's family, which is huge and wonderful family. I love them so much. And I love my Strieber family too. Anyway, is this a family affair? And is that something that identifies its connection to my family? And is that why I wasn't scared of them, but didn't like them very much either? I thought they were interfering in my life somehow. I don't know the answer to those questions. Goodness me. 80 years old. I can't believe I'm 80. I wonder how much longer I'll be here. There'll come a day when this chair is empty. Then I always say to myself, if I don't get to be with my Annie, I don't want to be anywhere. This is a marriage. These two rings are a marriage. They are a marriage. Gosh, I remember so many things about Annie. Annie came off as a very sort of ordinary person like me. She was very, very bright. She was extremely intelligent. You know, when I was looking for a girlfriend and a wife, living in New York, lonely and going to singles bars, and I don't like to tell a lie. So, you know, I'm telling the girls at the singles bars, yeah, I'm a media planner at Benton and Bowles advertising. And they're not interested in a media planner's making $125 a week or something. They're interested in all the other guys who are lawyers and doctors and airline pilots and stuff. Most of them were media planners and account executives themselves. But that's not what they, you know, they wanted the girls. They didn't care about whether or not they were lying to get them. But I did care. My dad used to say that a man loses a little bit of his life every time he tells a lie. And the visitors have said they're like lies are like lead weights. They weigh you down bit by bit. So your soul slips away and slides and can't ascend. So, no lies.
Well, things have obviously changed in here a little bit. We had the usual proliferation of electronic glitches, and I'm on a new computer entirely. I mean, not literally a new, different computer. And I've got a few more things to say, of course, but before we go on, I'm going to talk about one childhood incident that I haven't yet discussed that has always fascinated me. It has to do with the anti-gravity machine I attempted to make. I talk about this in The Secret School, and I've talked about it elsewhere. And this is one of those things that, even though The Secret School, as I've said, is full of imaginary stuff, this is not imaginary in my opinion. I think this happened pretty much as I'm going to describe it. At some point, I was I had some kind of an interaction with them, because I woke up one morning possessed with, and I can almost remember it as I'm talking, almost bring it to mind. It's that close. Anyway, I woke up the next morning, I guess the morning after it happened, possessed to build an anti-gravity device and convinced that I had been taught to do so by the spacemen. You know, in those days, I used to talk so much about the spacemen. They were in my life, only I didn't really understand that, and neither did anyone else. One of my best friend's mothers remembered me saying, as a little child, when I stayed over at their house, that I was afraid of the spacemen coming to get me. And, I guess they were. I don't know what else to say about it. I now know that I'm not the only person who has had this experience in their childhood. So I think it's something we just need to get used to. A lot of us have had this experience. Anyway, here's what happened. I wake up the next morning absolutely possessed with the idea of building an anti-gravity machine and convinced I know how to do it. So what happens then is we found, myself and a friend of mine, found two magnets. One of them was a donut magnet and one of them was a little round one. And what I knew was that magnetism somehow was very important in this. And I think that we will understand in the future, if we don't understand behind closed doors now, how important magnetism actually is. Because I think that UFOs are associated with ultra high intensity magnetic fields. And I think there's a lot of evidence of that. In fact, there's one document called the Condon Report, which you can find on Unknown Country, or just Google Condon Report, and you'll see the whole thing. It's not classified. It's a British intelligence report that analyzes what they call plasmas, which they really mean UFOs, and their known effects, including effects on people. And they discuss extensively in that, as I recall, magnetic fields. High-intensity magnetic fields and different sorts of energetic fields around them. Anyway, I was possessed, and you know the other stories. I would get possessed by these things. I thought it was that obsessive strain in my personality. So the next thing I knew, we're hunting up magnets, and we find a little round magnet, electromagnet, and we find the donut electromagnet. We stick the little round one inside the donut and we plug them both in. Now, you can imagine that that would have caused some trouble, and it did. The two magnets went kind of crazy for a few seconds, and then kapow, the hall of fuses. This was before they had switches. It was all fuses, and the fuses all blew out, and the electricity blew out, and of course I hear from downstairs my mother and the maid both yelling, "Witty, what have you done?" Never occurred to them that it might have been not me. Of course they assumed it was me, and of course they were entirely right. I of course yelled, "Nothing, mother. Well, turn the lights back on." And so I ran downstairs. I was running, rummaging through the storage space to find fuses. There, of course, we had a lot of them because they used to blow out fairly frequently. And so I got it all refused and got the lights all back on. And my mother says, "Whatever you did, don't do it again." Because Annie was ironing and she's late and wants to finish her work in time. And I don't like to have things like that happen. It just feels like the house is going to explode one of these days, really. Oh, Mama said, "I'm sorry. I didn't do it, but I did get it fixed." And then she said, "Well, whatever that buzzing was that came out of your room, if I hear that again, you're in trouble." So, and anyway, The next day, I go up to our country house with my grandmother and some of her friends. They like to take me because I am quite good at playing certain card games. And they like to play these games and have an opponent who is fairly formidable. One of them was called Spite and Malice, or Hate and Malice. And I was hard to beat at that game, very hard to beat. The only person who could beat me, and she never failed, Annie, my wife, she could beat me at that game, and she was always beat me. It was extremely frustrating. Anyway, I used to play it with my grandmother, and the other ladies were eager for this to happen because my grandmother was a very sophisticated lady with a slight British accent. She'd been raised by her mother was English from England, and she had a sort of mid-Atlantic accent, and she was very proper, but not when she was being frustrated in Hate and Malice. Then she would begin to yell curses that would embarrass a Marine drill sergeant. And the other ladies delighted in this. "Oh, Kafer, how can you say things like that? Well, you knew what would happen. That's why you've got me to play with him." "Well, you should try to be more discreet," and they're, of course, laughing up their sleeves at her. Anyway, we're up at the country house, and all of a sudden the phone rings. My grandmother answers it, and I hear her say, "House burned down. Mary Strieber's house burned down." And I think, uh-oh. And it developed that my house, the roof had caught fire, mysteriously. No one knew how it happened. But the night before, we were playing Monopoly in my bedroom. And this was now the electrical catastrophe had happened with the magnets. Now it's the evening, and we're all playing, my sister and I and probably some friends are playing Monopoly, when suddenly the house goes, the lights begin to pulsate, and there's sort of a woo, and the lights are pulsating, and then they stop. And we, at first we're afraid they're going to go out, and I'm thinking, I hope there are more fuses, but they don't go out, so we continue our game and forget about it. I think then, when I hear that the house is burned down, it sounded on the phone that it had burned to the ground. It was turned out it was only the roof, and it was a cedar shake roof, so it really wasn't a lot of damage. My sister was really annoyed, though, because it never occurred to anyone in the family that it didn't have something to do with me. And I would say, but I was at the country. I was in the country house. I was 50 miles away. And my mother said, "Well, all I can say is your father better never figure it out, because he was also gone. So he didn't know what had happened." And to this day, I don't know how it happened. And I don't even know if it's related to, I thought that the magnetic attempt to build the anti-gravity machine pissed off the visitors. And they did that to warn me to stay away from that sort of thing. Although that's just a conjecture. I can't be sure. In any case, I had a sort of come to Jesus moment when I heard the house had burned down, I can assure you. And my sister was outraged because my sister was the person who absolutely assumed that anything unusual that happened was caused by me. And her room caved in, and mine didn't. And she was very angry about that, because she said to me, "Whitley, I am going to get you." So we had to live at our grandmother's house, and it was pretty confused for the next few months, when the whole place had to be rebuilt. The roof rebuilt and everything repainted, and the ceilings replastered and everything. Anyway, that was one of the things that happened as a child. And I also remember another incident, a wonderful experience that was, and this is, again, in normal memory. This isn't something that came to me after the Don Klein and in my second hypnosis session suddenly said, "How old are you?" And I heard my little old 11-year-old voice pipe up, or 12-year-old voice pipe up, 12. I hadn't at that time had any memory of anything like this happening in my childhood. So I didn't really think about the memory I'm about to tell you, but it was always there. It was always there. The memory is this. I am on a what looks like a kind of a big old life raft with those big tubular sides. It's dark blue, and there are some other kids on the life raft. And the little blue guys who were there in my childhood, I'm sure of it, are running around in this thing, gasping and pulling at our legs because we're leaning over the side, and it's floating over the neighborhood at night. And I'm looking down at the houses, and it was so much fun. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Talk about fun. Boy, there was no fear at all. I remember it very well. And I always remembered it. But I didn't associate it with aliens. I didn't associate it with anything. I never thought about it much. It would come to mind every once in a while when I was thinking about the old neighborhood. And I would wonder myself, how can I remember that? But I did. I do still. It's funny, isn't it, that the experience so often is not threatening to children. And I don't recall it being threatening to me, except obviously it was, because I wouldn't have made those spears and wanted them to go away. It was like they were invading some kind of secret part of my life, and almost as if they were going to take me too close to the edge of the stream of time, and I would see my future, and it would ruin my chance to gain energy from moving in the time stream. I suspect that's what was happening, although, of course, I can't be sure of that. In any case, that's a childhood memory. Now I'm going to talk about one, and I want to sort of record this because I rarely talk about it. I did not know that we did not remember going into the womb, because I've remembered that. And I think I told friends at some point this story, just reminiscing. I thought everyone remembered this. And they were so upset and incredulous that it would embarrass me, and I didn't talk about it anymore. Anyway, I remember very well going into the womb. I remember it quite well. And I'm going to describe it now because it's such a lovely, lovely experience. And I want it to be in my record. Then I have to recognize over time, my record is really weird. And okay, I'm living life on a kind of a different frequency. And that's fine. It's been a good life. Weird, but good. I had a wonderful marriage. Oh my gosh, goodness. And I had her in my life too, and still do. The last time she was in my life was about 4 or 5 weeks ago, when she showed up in a friend's house here in Los Angeles, because we're working together on a project. I'm not going to go down that road. I wish I could. I will later be able to go down to it in great detail, I promise you, with her. But right now, no, it's not ready. Suffice to say, she or somebody who looks very like her is still around, and still has the same wonderful disposition, strict, but really strict. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. There will come a time. Talking about the childhood, the babyhood, the pre-babyhood experience, I'm going to close my eyes and I'll take myself back, and I'm going to tell you about the experience itself as it was. Here's what I remember. I remember looking back at this beautiful light, and I was coming from it, and I felt I was very tiny, and I felt this journey was so secret. It was thrillingly secret. And I came down and I looked below me, and the clouds, there were summer clouds below me. I was very high, and I was coming down, and I remember the most extraordinary sense of peace within me. Deep, deep peace within me, and happiness. I was joyous. And I come down and this sense of being kind of sneaking in is very palpable and it's thrilling. And I get down below the clouds and there are trees, the tops of trees, and I can see the roof of a house. And I'm going down and I go down through the trees and I hear cicadas humming in the trees as I move past. And I'm very careful not even to disturb them because I'm sneaking into the time stream, I think. And I've always loved the sound of cicadas because of that moment and the sense of peace and quiet in that moment. And then I go through a roof and I look down below me and lying on a bed asleep, taking, I guess, an afternoon nap, is a little woman. And she's pregnant, and I know this. And there's some kind an energy that I now feel quite often, which I now know is Kundalini energy, comes, and I feel this wonderful, vibrating sense of connection to her. And I go down closer and closer to her, and suddenly, whoosh, 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 it feels like I'm in a factory. And then a dialogue starts between us. And we're talking about life and what we'll do together. And it's such a companionship. Oh my goodness. You and your mother are incredibly deep friends. We forget all of this. You know, I think that before we can speak, we probably all remember these things. We remember where we came from. We remember who we were in past lives. We remember it all. But as we come to be able to speak and our egos start to grow, those memories slip back into the past and that door closes. The door of innocence closes and the door of experience opens. And that's what we're supposed to do. That's why we're here. We're here to have experience in time. Everything is new every second for us human beings. And this is the great treasure of being alive and so richly conscious and so richly provided with sensation and senses in these wonderful bodies. Love your body, even if you're suffering and even if it's not working right. Love it anyway. Because as Annie said, I asked Annie once about compassion, and she said, "Witty, each of us is all we have." And that just opened my heart. It opened my heart to everybody. You try it. You walk down the street and you look at every person you're passing there deep in their own lives and you think, he's all he has. She's all she has. And that little dog walking along over there is all he has. And the dove and the mockingbird standing on the wire singing, they're all they have. The plant, tree over there, the grass, it's all it has. It changes the world. She was really powerful, Annie. That was a real big soul in that little old body, that little gal from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And that's a reminder of, you know, that people go around in these guru suits and I've seen people worshiping other people. Annie was probably one of the most enlightened people who was alive during her lifetime. And she would have scoffed at that. She did scoff at it. She called it guru-itis. You don't have to show off. Your place in the world will find itself. Each of us is all we have. And I went into that body, and I became my mother's son. Unfortunately, when my mother was leaving the world, there was a screw-up, and we didn't get there in time. One of her last things she said was, "Where's Whitty?" Well, it's such a strange world. You know, my great-grandmother's house is on St. Mary's Street in San Antonio. It's now Providence High School, and part of Providence High School, and they have restored it, by the way, very nicely. And I have a feeling if you go there and ask to see it, the nuns will probably let you come in and take a look. And that was my great-grandmother's house. And next door to it is a funeral home called the Angelus Funeral Home. That's where my mother's my grandmother and grandfather's house was, that house next door. And that my mother was born in that house. And when she died, she was buried from the Angelus Funeral Home she was buried inside the funeral home from approximately the same place in the funeral home where the bedroom would have been where she was born. Man comes and tills the soil and lies beneath, and after many a summer dies the swan. That's a quote that I used in The Hunger. It's from, I believe, John Keats's Tithonus. Wonderful long poem. Nobody reads long poems anymore. We've demythologized our words. Words aren't as magic as they used to be. But you have to make your magic with words. And those long poems, letting them flow in your mind, not looking for any answers, just letting the words flow. You can really get a lot out of those poems. That's one of them that's filled with, it sounds bombastic, a lot of it, but you let the words do their magic and something changes. My goodness. 80 years, gosh, and you guys have been with me, many of you, for half of that time. Some of you started in 1988 with communion and have been with me ever since. Many, many, a beloved friend has passed on from this veil, and I will too. And I want to tell you that no matter what happens to me, I have loved life. I have been loved in this life, and I have given love in this life. It's all we really have. Another thing that my teacher said, enlightenment is what happens when there is nothing left of us but love. Now, I was at Contact in the Desert the other day, and Diane Hennessy Powell was there. And there was a panel discussion. Chris Ramsey, who is the Area 52 host, is also an extraordinarily accomplished magician. When I went to Area 52 and did the interview, after the interview, he showed me some card tricks that were almost supernatural themselves. They were so well done. And I said, Chris, is there ever any real magic? And he said, oh, sure. Lots of magicians have moments of real magic. I've had a few myself, and where you can't explain it. So he was there as an observer, not a participant, because this is a man who's going to know if a trick is a trick and not real. with Dr. Powell was a unvoiced girl of 14 and her mother. And they proceeded to demonstrate telepathy so vividly. It was incredible. Incredible. They totally convincing. The mother had so many blindfolds on that there was no way she could see. There was no way she could be signaled, because the what was being done from the audience at random, by random audience members. So it wasn't a setup. It was totally convincing. And I will tell you something that really stood out in my mind, and that is very much related to how Kai Dickens talks about the unvoiced descriptions of what it needs to be telepathic. And that was the mother and the daughter were enjoying themselves so much. They were smiling and laughing and full of joy and fun. And they were having fun. We can't be afraid to have fun. Have joy, Annie said. Have joy. She knew that was the most important thing the visitors ever said to anybody. Have joy, those two words. Because that's where the energy lies, and that's where the future of man actually lies. We scream at each other. We bellyache. We do politics. We kill each other all the time for no goddamn good reason. There's never been a good war. There aren't any good wars. Wars are like an affliction. They're a disease. And then these idiots go around and shoot each other all the time. My God, what a disaster. Anyway, it doesn't have to be that way, not in your life and not in mine. We can live in our joy anyway. So, Kai Dickens mentions in the telepathy tapes that the spellers, as she calls them, the unvoiced, say that there are two things necessary. You have to be kind, and you must not lie. And why must you not lie? You must not lie because you have to be open when you're telepathic. I've been telepathic many times with the visitors and with the hybrids who... And I've gotten used to that. At first, it was very scary. But I know now that the hybrids love me and they protect me in many different ways. And I love them, even though they're not like me. And they get very shy when I'm around them because I can hear them telepathically and other people can't. And they feel extremely vulnerable in our world because they cannot speak. They cannot explain themselves. They probably don't have any identification. They're not part of the economy. They don't fit in any way. And you know what would happen if they got captured by the government? They'd be taken apart bit by bit, and they know it, believe me. They would have no rights. And I know, because I, in the fourth mind, it's obvious that government has dissected these people, and I think they've probably shot and killed some of them too. If Jake Barber's suggestion is correct, that psionics guy who said that they attracted them and then shot at him, come on. And people say to me, why don't they just land on the White House lawn? Oh, really? Do you think you would land in a hornet's nest if you were a little ant? I don't think so. And the Varginha alien who gave us the extraordinary message that they felt sorry for us, and this is also in the fourth month, they felt sorry for us not because we didn't have their powers, but because we had lost them. Telepathy, levitation, healing, all of these things are powers we can regain. But it starts with love. It starts with joy. The beginning of it is that mother and daughter smiling and having such a great time doing something that's supposed to be impossible. that a lot of people would have liked to shoot him dead for doing. No, it's over. Let's get past that. Let's find our peace inside ourselves and find our joy. I want an 80th birthday present from you. And you know what that is? I want you to spend some time looking inside yourself for the most joyous moments in your whole life. And you take those moments and you put them in a place inside you where you can always go there. And that's your home. You make your moments of joy your home inside your soul. And go there whenever you're feeling blue or struggling or in pain. Always go to your joy. That'll be the best birthday present I could have. I love you all very much. Don't forget to come to Dreamland. Come to Unknown Country. They're lovely places and very special. They won't be here forever. I won't be. Be well. God bless you.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Anne Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.